21. Bailey stuck branches in the ground behind the house and covered them with a worn-through blanket, making a tent. It was to be his Captain Marvel hideaway. There he initiated girls into the mysteries of sex. One by one, he took the impressed, the curious, the adventurous into the gray shadows, after explaining that they were going to play Mama and Papa. I was assigned the role of baby and lookout. The girls were commanded to pull up their dresses, and then he lay on top and wiggled his hips. I sometimes had to lift the flap. I signaled that an adult was approaching. And so I saw their pathetic struggles even as they talked about school and the movies. He had been playing the game for about 6 months before he met Joyce. She was a country girl about 4 years older than Bailey. He wasn't quite 11 when they met, whose parents had died, and she, along with her brothers and sisters, had been parceled out to relatives. Joyce had come to Stamps to live with a widowed aunt, who was even poorer than the poorest person in town. Joyce was quite advanced physically for her age. Her breasts were not the hard little knots of other girls her age. They filled out the tops of her skimpy little dresses. She walked stiffly, as if she were carrying a load of wood between her legs. I thought of her as being coarse, but Bailey said she was cute and that he wanted to play house with her. In the special way of women, Joyce knew she had made a conquest and managed to hang around the store in the late afternoons and all day Saturdays. She ran errands for Mama when we were busy in the store and sweated profusely. Often when she came in after running down the hill, her cotton dress would cling to her thin body, and Bailey would glue his eyes on her until her clothes dried. Mama gave her small gifts of food to take to her aunt, and on Saturdays, Uncle Willie sometimes gave her a dime for show fare. During Passover week, we weren't allowed to go to the movies. Mama said we all must sacrifice to purify our souls, and Bailey and Joyce decided that the three of us would play house. As usual, I was to be baby. He strung the tent, and Joyce crawled in first. Bailey told me to sit outside and play with my doll baby, and he went in, and the flap closed. "Well, ain't you going to open your trousers?" Joyce's voice was muffled. "No, you just pull up your dress." There were rustling sounds from the tent, and the sides pooched out as if they were trying to stand up. Bailey asked, "What are you doing?" "Pulling off my drawers." "What for?" "We can't do it with my drawers on."
"Why not?"
"How are you going to get to it?"
Silence.
My poor brother didn't know what she meant.
I knew.
I lifted the flap and said, "Joyce, don't you do that to my brother." She nearly screamed, but she kept her voice low. "Margaret, you close that door." Bailey added,
"Yes, close it. You're supposed to be playing with our doll baby."
I thought he would go to the hospital if he let her do that to him. So I warned him, "Bailey, if you let her do that to you, you'll be sorry." But he threatened that if I didn't close the door, he wouldn't speak to me for a month. So I let the end of the blanket fall and sat down on the grass in front of the tent. Joyce poked her head out and said in a sugary, white woman in the movies voice, "Baby, you go get some wood. Daddy and I going to light a fire. Then I'm going to make you some cake." Then her voice changed as if she was going to hit me. "Go, get."
Bailey told me after that Joyce had hairs on her thing, and that she had gotten them from doing it with so many boys. She even had hair under her arms, both of them. He was very proud of her accomplishments. As their love affair progressed, his stealing from the store increased. We had always taken candy and a few nickels, and of course the sour pickles. But Bailey, now called upon to feed Joyce's ravening hunger, took cans of sardines and greasy Polish sausage and cheese and even the expensive cans of pink salmon that our family could seldom afford to eat. Joyce's willingness to do odd jobs slackened about this time. She complained that she wasn't feeling all that well. But since now she had a few coins, she still hung around the store, eating Planters peanuts and drinking Dr. Pepper. Mama ran her off a few times. "Ain't you said you wasn't feeling well, Joyce? Hadn't you better get home and let your auntie do something for you?" "Yes, ma'am." Then reluctantly she was off the porch, her stiff-legged walk carrying her up the hill and out of sight. I think she was Bailey's first love outside the family. For him, she was the mother who let him get as close as he dreamed, the sister who wasn't moody and withdrawing and teary and tender-hearted. All he had to do was keep the food coming in, and she kept the affection flowing. It made no difference to him that she was almost a woman. Or possibly it was just that difference which made her so appealing. She was around for a few months, and as she had appeared out of limbo, so she disappeared into nothingness. There was no gossip about her, no clues to her leaving or her whereabouts. I noticed a change in Bailey before I discovered that she was gone. He lost his interest in everything. He mulled around, and it would be safe to say he paled. Mama noticed and said that he was feeling poorly because of the change in seasons. We were nearing fall, so she went to the woods for certain leaves, made him a tea, and forced him to drink it after a heaping spoonful of sulfur and molasses. The fact that he didn't fight it, didn't try to talk his way out of taking the medicine, showed without a glimmer of doubt he was very sick. If I had disliked Joyce while she had Bailey in her grasp, I hated her for leaving. I missed the tolerance she had brought to him. He had nearly given up sarcasm and playing jokes on the country people, and he had taken to telling me his secrets again. But now that she was gone, he rivaled me in being uncommunicative. He closed in upon himself like a pond swallowing a stone. There was no evidence that he had ever opened up, and when I mentioned her, he responded with, "Joyce who?" Months later, when Mama was waiting on Joyce's aunt, she said, "Yes, ma'am, Mrs. Goodman, life's just one thing right after the other." Mrs. Goodman was leaning on the red Coca-Cola box. "That's the blessed truth, Sister Henderson." She sipped the expensive drink. "Things change so fast, it make your head swim." I stayed mouse quiet so that I'd be able to hear the gossip and take it to Bailey. "Now you take little Joyce. She used to be around the store all the time. Then she went up just like smoke. We ain't seen hide nor hair of her in months. No, I'm ashamed to tell you what took her off." She settled in on a kitchen chair. Mama spied me in the shadows. "Sister,
The Lord don't like little jugs with big ears. You ain't got something to do? I'll find something for you. The truth had to float to me through the kitchen door. I ain't got much, Sister Emerson, but I give that child all I had. Mama said she bound that was true. She wouldn't say bet. And after all I did, she run off with one of those railroad porters. She was loose just like her mammy before her. You know how they say blood will tell. Mama asked, how did the snake catch her? Well, now understand me, Sister Henderson. I don't hold this against you. I know you a God-fearing woman. But it seemed like she met him here. Mama was flustered. Such goings on at the store. She asked, at the store? Yes, ma'am. Remember when that bunch of elves come over for their baseball game? Mama must have remembered. I did. Well, as it turned out, he was one of them. She left me a T90 note. Said people in stamps thought they were better than she was, and that she hadn't only made one friend, and that was your grandson. Said she was moving to Dallas, Texas, and gonna marry that railroad porter. Mama said, do Lord. Mrs. Goodman said, you know, Sister Henderson, she wasn't with me long enough for me to get the real habit of her, but I still miss her. She was sweet when she wanted to be. Mama consoled her with, well, we got to keep our mind on the works of the book. It say, the Lord giveth and the Lord taketh away. Mrs. Goodman chimed in, and they finished the phrase together. Blessed be the name of the Lord. I don't know how long Bailey had known about Joyce, but later in the evening, when I tried to bring her name into our conversation, he said, Joyce, she's got somebody to do it to her all the time now. And that was the last time her name was mentioned. 22. The wind blew over the roof and ruffled the shingles. It whistled sharp under the closed door. The chimney made fearful sounds of protest as it was invaded by the urgent gusts. A mile away, old Kansas City Kate, the train much admired but too important to stop in stamps, crashed through the middle of town, blew its woo-wee warnings, and continued to an unknown glamorous destination without looking back. There was going to be a storm, and it was a perfect night for rereading Jane Eyre. Bailey had finished his chores and was already behind the stove with Mark Twain. It was my turn to close the store, and my book, half read, lay on the candy counter. Since the weather was going to be bad, I was sure Uncle Willie would agree, in fact, encourage me to close early, save electricity, and join the family in Mama's bedroom, which functioned as our sitting room. Few people would be out in weather that threatened a tornado, for though the wind blew, the sky was as clear and still as a summer morning. Mama agreed that I might as well close, and I went out on the porch, closed the shutters, slipped the wooden bar over the door, and turned off the light. Pots rattled in the kitchen, where Mama was frying corn cakes to go with vegetable soup for supper. And the homey sounds and scents cushioned me as I read of Jane Eyre and the cold English mansion of a colder English gentleman. Uncle Willie was engrossed in the almanac, his nightly reading, and my brother was far away on a raft on the Mississippi. I was the first to hear the rattle on the back door, a rattle and knock and rattle, but suspecting that it might have been the mad wife in the tower. I didn't credit it. Then Uncle Willie heard it and summoned Bailey back from Huck Finn to unlatch the bolt. Through the open door, the moonshine fell into the room in a cold radiance to rival our meager lamplight. We all waited, I with a dread expectancy, for no human being was there. The wind alone came in, struggling with the weak flame in the coal oil lamp, pushing and bunting about the family warmth of our pot-bellied stove. Uncle Willie thought it must have been the storm and told Bailey to close the door. But just before he secured the raw wooden slab, a voice drifted through the crack. It wheezed, "Sister Henderson, Brother Willie." Bailey nearly closed the door again, but Uncle Willie asked, "Who is it?" And Mr. George Taylor's pinched brown face swam out of the gray and into view. He assured himself that we hadn't gone to bed and was welcomed in. When Mama saw him, she invited him to stay for supper and told me to stick some sweet potatoes in the ashes to stretch the evening meal. Poor Brother Taylor had been taking meals all over town ever since he buried his wife in the summer. Maybe due to the fact that I was in my romanticist period, or because children have a built-in survival apparatus, I feared he was interested in marrying Mama and moving in with us. Uncle Willie cradled the almanac in his divided lap. "You welcome here any time, Brother Taylor, any time. But this is a bad night." It say right here, with his crippled hand, he wrapped the almanac, that November 12th, a storm going to be moving over Stamps out of the east. A rough night. Mr. Taylor remained exactly in the same position he had taken when he arrived, like a person too cold to readjust his body, even to get closer to the fire. His neck was bent, and the red light played over the polished skin of his hairless head. But his eyes bound me with a unique attraction. They sat deep in his little face and completely dominated the other features with a roundness which seemed to be outlined in dark pencil, giving him an owlish appearance. And when he sensed my regarding him so steadily, his head hardly moved, but his eyes swirled and landed on me. If his look had contained contempt or patronage, or any of the vulgar emotions revealed by adults in confrontation with children, I would have easily gone back to my book. But his eyes gave off a watery nothing, a nothingness, which was completely unbearable. I saw a glassiness observed before only in new marbles, or a bottle top embedded in a block of ice. His glance moved so swiftly from me that it was nearly possible to imagine that I had in fact imagined the interchange. "But as I say, you welcome. We can always make a place under this roof." Uncle Willie didn't seem to notice that Mr. Taylor was oblivious to everything he said. Mama brought the soup into the room, took the kettle off the heater, and placed the steaming pot on the fire. Uncle Willie continued, "Mama, I told Brother Taylor he is welcome here any time." Mama said, "That's right, Brother Taylor. You're not supposed to sit around that lonely house feeling sorry for yourself. The Lord giveth and the Lord taketh away." I'm not sure whether it was Mama's presence or the bubbling soup on the stove which influenced him, but Mr. Taylor appeared to have livened up considerably. He shook his shoulders as if shaking off a tiresome touch and attempted a smile that failed. "Sister Henderson, I sure appreciate, I don't know what I'd do if it wasn't for everybody. You don't know what it's worth to me to be able to... I'm thankful." At each pause, he
pecked his head over his chest like a turtle coming out of its shell, but his eyes didn't move. Mama, always self-conscious at public displays of emotions, not traceable to a religious source, told me to come with her, and we'd bring the bread and bowls. She carried the food, and I trailed after her, bringing the kerosene lamp. The new light set the room in an eerie, harsh perspective. Bailey still sat double over his book, a black hunchback gnome, a finger forerunning his eyes along the page. Uncle Willie and Mr. Taylor were frozen like people in a book on the history of the American Negro. "Now, come on, Brother Taylor," Mama was pressing a bowl of soup on him. "You may not be hungry, but take this for nourishment." Her voice had the tender concern of a healthy person speaking to an invalid, and her plain statement rang thrillingly true. "I am thankful." Bailey came out of his absorption and went to wash his hands. "Willie, say the blessing." Mama set Bailey's bowl down and bowed her head. During grace, Bailey stood in the doorway, a figure of obedience. But I knew his mind was on Tom Sawyer and Jim, as mine would have been on Jane Eyre and Mr. Rochester, but for the glittering eyes of wizened old Mr. Taylor. Our guest dutifully took a few spoonsful of soup and bit a semicircle in the bread, then put his bowl on the floor. Something in the fire held his attention as we ate noisily. Noticing his withdrawal, Mama said, "It won't do for you to take on so. I know you all was together a long time." Uncle Willie said, 40 years. "But it's been around 6 months since she's gone to her rest, and you got to keep faith. He never gives us more than we can bear." The statement heartened Mr. Taylor. He picked up his bowl again and raked his spoon through the thick soup. Mama saw that she had made some contact, so she went on. "You had a whole lot of good years. Got to be grateful for them. Only thing is, it's a pity you all didn't have some children." If my head had been down, I would have missed Mr. Taylor's metamorphosis. It was not a change that came by steps, but rather it seemed to me all of a sudden. His bowl was on the floor with a thud, and his body leaned toward Mama from the hips. However, his face was the most striking feature of all. The brown expanse seemed to darken with light, as if an inner agitation played under his thin skin. The mouth, open to show the long teeth, was a dark room furnished with a few white chairs. "Children," he gumballed the word around in his empty mouth. "Yes, sir, children." Bailey and I, used to be addressed so, looked at him expectantly. "That's what she wants." His eyes were vital and straining to jump from the imprisoning sockets. "That's what she said. Children." The air was weighted and thick. A bigger house had been set on our roof and was imperceptibly pushing us into the ground. Mama asked in her nice folks' voice, "What who said, Brother Taylor?" She knew the answer. We all knew the answer. "Florida." His little wrinkled hands were making fists, then straightening, then making fists again. "She said it just last night." Bailey and I looked at each other, and I hunched my chair closer to him. "Said, I want some children." When he pitched his already high voice to what he considered a feminine level, or at any rate, to his wife's, Miss Florida's, level, it streaked across the room, zigzagging like lightning. Uncle Willie had stopped eating and was regarding him with something like pity. Maybe you was dreaming, Brother Taylor. Could have been a dream. Mama came in placatingly. That's right. You know, the children was reading me something the other day. Say folks dream about whatever was on their mind when they went to sleep. Mr. Taylor jerked himself up. It was not no dream. I was as wide awake as I am this very minute. He was angry, and the tension increased his little mask of strength. I'll tell you what happened. Oh, Lord, a ghost story. I hated and dreaded the long winter nights when late customers came to the store to sit around the heater, roasting peanuts and trying to best each other in telling lurid tales of ghosts and haints, banshees and juju, voodoo, and other anti-life stories. But a real one that happened to a real person. And last night, it was going to be intolerable. I got up and walked to the window. Mrs. Florida Taylor's funeral in June came on the heels of our final exams. Bailey and Louise and I had done very well and were pleased with ourselves and each other. The summer stretched golden in front of us, with promises of picnics and fish fries, blackberry hunts and croquet games till dark. It would have taken a personal loss to penetrate my sense of well-being. I had met and loved the Bronte sisters and had replaced Kipling's If with Invictus. My friendship with Louise was solidified over Jack's, Hopscotch, and Confessions Deep and Dark, exchanged often after many a cross your heart you won't tell. I never talked about St. Louis to her and had generally come to believe that the nightmare with its attendant guilt and fear hadn't really happened to me. It happened to a nasty little girl years and years before who had no chain on me at all. At first, the news that Mrs. Taylor was dead did not strike me as a particularly newsy bit of information. As children do, I thought that since she was very old, she had only one thing to do, and that was to die. She was a pleasant enough woman, with her steps made mincing by age, and her little hands like gentle claws that liked to touch young skin. Each time she came to the store, I was forced to go up to her while she raked her yellow nails down my cheeks. You sure got a pretty complexion. It was a rare compliment in a world of very few such words of praise, so it balanced being touched by the dry fingers. You going to the funeral, sister? Mama wasn't asking a question. Mama said, you going, 'cause Sister Taylor thought so much of you. She left you her yellow brooch. She wouldn't say gold, because it wasn't. She told Brother Taylor, I want Sister Henderson's grandbaby to have my gold brooch. So, you'll have to go. I had followed a few coffins up the hill from the church to the cemetery. But because Mama said I was tender-hearted, I had never been forced to sit through a funeral service. At 11 years old, death is more unreal than frightening. It seemed a waste of a good afternoon to sit in church for a silly old brooch, which was not only not gold, but was too old for me to wear. But if Mama said I had to go, it was certain that I would be there. The mourners on the front benches sat in a blue serge, black crepe dress gloom. A funeral hymn made its way around the church, tediously but successfully. It eased into the heart of every gay thought, into the care of each happy memory, shattering the light and hopeful. On the other side of Jordan, there is a peace for the weary. There is a peace for me. The inevitable destination of all living things seemed but a short step away, I had never considered before that dying, death, dead, passed away were words and phrases that might be even faintly connected with me. But on that onerous day, oppressed beyond relief, my own mortality was borne in upon me on sluggish tides of doom. No sooner had the mournful song run its course than the minister took to the altar and delivered a sermon that in my state gave little comfort. Its subject was, "Thou art my good and faithful servant, with whom I am well pleased." His voice inweaved itself through the somber vapors left by the dirge. In a monotonous tone, he warned the listeners that this day might be your last, and the best insurance against dying a sinner was to make yourself right with God, so that on the faithful day he would say, "Thou art my good and faithful servant, with whom I am well pleased." After he had put the fear of the cold grave under our skins, he began to speak of Mrs. Taylor, a godly woman who gave to the poor, visited the sick, tithed to the church, and in general lived a life of goodliness. At this point, he began to talk directly to the coffin, which I had noticed upon my arrival and had studiously avoided thereafter. "I hungered, and you gave me to eat. I was thirsty, and you gave me to drink. I was sick, and you visited me. In prison, and you left me not. Inasmuch as you have done it unto the least of one of these, you have done it unto me." He bounded off the dais and approached the velvet gray box. With an imperious gesture, he snatched the gray cloth off the open flap and gazed down into the mystery. "Sleep on, thy graceful soul, till Christ calls you to come forth into his bright heaven." He continued speaking directly to the dead woman, and I half wished she would rise up and answer him, offended by the coarseness of his approach. A scream burst from Mr. Taylor. He stood up suddenly and lengthened his arms toward the minister, the coffin, and his wife's corpse. For a long minute he hovered, his back to the church, as the instructive words kept falling around the room, rich with promise, full with warnings. Mama and other ladies caught him in time to bring him back to the bench, where he quickly folded upon himself like a Brer Rabbit rag doll. Mr. Taylor and the high church officials were the first to file around the bier to wave farewell to the departed and get a glimpse of what lay in store for all men. Then on heavy feet, made more ponderous by the guilt of the living viewing the dead, the adult church marched up to the coffin and back to their seats, their faces, which showed apprehension before reaching the coffin, revealed on the way down the opposite aisle a final confirmation of their fears. Watching them was a little like peeping through a window when the shade is not drawn flush. Although I didn't try, it was impossible not to record their roles in the drama. And then a black-dressed usher stuck her hand out woodenly toward the children's rows. There was the shifty rustling of unreadiness, but finally a boy of 14 led us off, and I dared not hang back, as much as I hated the idea of seeing Mrs. Taylor. Up the aisle, the moans and screams merged with the sickening smell of woolen black clothes worn in summer weather and green leaves wilting over yellow flowers. I couldn't distinguish whether I was smelling the clutching sound of misery or hearing the cloying odor of death. It would have been easier to see her through the gauze, but instead I looked down on the stark face that seemed suddenly so empty and evil. It knew secrets that I never wanted to share. The cheeks had fallen back to the ears, and a solicitous mortician had put lipstick on the black mouth. The scent of decay was sweet and clasping. It groped for life with a hunger both greedy and hateful, but it was hypnotic. I wanted to be off, but my shoes had glued themselves to the floor, and I had to hold on to the sides of the coffin to remain standing. The unexpected halt in the moving line caused the children to press upon each other, and whispers of no small intent reached my ears. "Move along, sister, move along." It was Mama. Her voice tugged at my will, and someone pushed from the rear, so I was freed. Instantly, I surrendered myself to the grimness of death. The change it had been able to effect in Mrs. Taylor showed that its strength could not be resisted. Her high-pitched voice, which parted the air in the store, was forever still, and the plump brown face had been deflated and patted flat like a cow's odorous dropping. The coffin was carried on a horse-drawn wagon to the cemetery, and all the way I communed with death's angels, questioning their choice of time, place, and person. For the first time, the burial ceremony had meaning for me. Ashes to ashes and dust to dust. It was certain that Mrs. Taylor was returning to the earth from whence she came. In fact, upon considering, I concluded that she had looked like a mud baby lying on the white satin of her velvet coffin. A mud baby molded into form by creative children on a rainy day, soon to run back into the loose earth. The memory of the grim ceremony had been so real to me that I was surprised to look up and see Mama and Uncle Willie eating by the stove. They were neither anxious nor hesitant, as if they knew a man has to say what he has to say. But I didn't want to hear any of it. And the wind, allying itself with me, threatened the china berry tree outside the back door. Last night, after I said my prayers, I lay down on the bed. Well, you know, it's the same bed she died on. "Oh, if he'd shut up," Mama said, "sister, sit down and eat your soup. Cold night like this, you need something hot in your stomach." "Go on, Brother Taylor, please." I sat down as near Bailey as possible. "Well, something told me to open my eyes." "What kind of something?" Mama asked, not laying down her spoon. "Yes, sir," Uncle Willie explained. "There can be a good something, and there can be a bad something." "Well, I wasn't sure, so I figured better open them, 'cause it could have been... Well, either one." I did, and the first thing, I saw a little baby angel. It was just as fat as a butterball, and laughing, eyes blue, blue, blue. Uncle Willie asked, "A baby angel?" "Yes, sir," and it was laughing right in my face. Then I heard this long moan, "Ah." "Well, as you say, Sister Henderson, we've been together for 40 years. I know Florida's voice." I wasn't scared right then. I called, "Florida?" Then that angel laughed harder, and the moan got louder. I set my bowl down and got closer to Bailey. Mrs. Taylor had been a very pleasant woman, smiling all the time, and patient. The only thing that jarred and bothered me when she came in the store was her voice. Like near-deaf people, she screamed, half not hearing what she was saying, and partly hoping her listeners would reply in kind. That was when she was living. The thought of that voice coming out of the grave and all the way down the hill from the cemetery
and hanging over my head was enough to straighten my hair. Yes, sir, he was looking at the stove, and the red glow fell on his face. It seemed as if he had a fire going inside his head. First I called, Florida, Florida, what do you want? And that devilish angel kept on laughing to beat the band. Mr. Taylor tried to laugh and only succeeded in looking frightened. I want some. That's when she said, I want some. He made his voice sound like the wind, if the wind had bronchial pneumonia. He wheezed, I want some children. Bailey and I met halfway on the drafty floor. Mama said, now, Brother Taylor, could be you was dreaming. You know, they say, whatever you goes to bed with on your mind. No, ma'am, Sister Henderson, I was as wide awake as I am right now. Did she let you see her? Uncle Willie had a dreamy look on his face. No, Willie, all I see was that fat little white baby angel. But was no mistaking that voice. I want some children. The cold wind had frozen my feet and my spine, and Mr. Taylor's impersonation had chilled my blood. Mama said, Sister, go bring the long fork to take the potatoes out. Ma'am? Surely she didn't mean the long fork that hung on the wall behind the kitchen stove, a scary million miles away. I said, go get the fork. The potatoes are burning. I unwound my legs from the gripping fear and almost tripped onto the stove. Mama said that child would stumble over the pattern in a rug. Go on, Brother Taylor. Did she say any more? I didn't want to hear it if she did, but I wasn't eager to leave the lighted room where my family sat around the friendly fire. Well, she said, ah, a few more times, and then that angel started to walk off the ceiling. I tell you, I was pretty near scared stiff. I had reached the no man's ocean of darkness. No great decision was called for. I knew it would be torturous to go through the thick blackness of Uncle Willie's bedroom, but it would be easier than staying around to hear the ghoulish story. Also, I couldn't afford to aggravate Mama. When she was displeased, she made me sleep on the edge of the bed, and that night I knew I needed to be close to her. 1 foot into the darkness, and the sense of detachment from reality nearly made me panic. The idea came to me that I might never get out into the light again. Quickly I found the door leading back to the familiar, but as I opened it, the awful story reached out and tried to grab my ears. I closed the door. Naturally, I believed in haints and ghosts and things. Having been raised by a super religious Southern Negro grandmother, it would have been abnormal had I not been superstitious. The trip to the kitchen and back could not have taken more than 2 minutes. Yet in that time, I tramped through swampy cemeteries, climbed over dusty gravestones, and eluded litters of night black cats. Back in the family circle, I remarked to myself how like a cyclopean eye was the belly of the red hot stove. It reminded me of the time when my daddy died. You know, we were very close. Mr. Taylor had hypnotized himself into the eerie world of horrors. I broke into his reminiscences. Mama, here's the fork. Bailey had lain down on his side behind the stove, and his eyes were shining. He was more fascinated with Mr. Taylor's morbid interest in his story than with the tale itself. Mama put her hand on my arm and said, you're shaking, sister. What's the matter? My skin still rippled from the experience of fear. Uncle Willie laughed and said, maybe she was scared to go in the kitchen. His high little laugh didn't fool me. Everyone was uneasy at being beckoned into the unknown. No, sir, I ain't never seen nothing so clear as that little angel baby. His jaws were scissoring mechanically on the already mushy sweet potatoes. Just laughing like a house on fire. What you reckon it means, Sister Henderson? Mama had reared back in her rocking chair, a half smile on her face. If you sure you wasn't dreaming, Brother Taylor. I was as wide awake as I am, he was becoming angry again, as I am right now. Well then, maybe it means I ought to know when I'm asleep and when I'm awake. Maybe it means Sister Florida wants you to work with the children in the church. One thing I always used to tell Florida, people won't let you get your words in edgewise. Could be she's trying to tell you, I ain't crazy, you know. My mind's just as good as it was to take a Sunday school class 30 years ago. If I say I was awake when I saw that little fat angel, then people ought to. Sunday school need more teachers. Lord knows that's so. Believe me when I say so. Their remarks and responses were like a ping-pong game, with each volley clearing the net and flying back to the opposition. The sense of what they were saying became lost, and only the exercise remained. The exchange was conducted with the certainty of a measured hoedown and had the jerkiness of Monday's wash snapping in the wind, now cracking east, then west, with only the intent to whip the dampness out of the cloth. Within a few minutes, the intoxication of doom had fled, as if it had never been, and Mama was encouraging Mr. Taylor to take in one of the Jenkins boys to help him with his farm. Uncle Willie was nodding at the fire, and Bailey had escaped back to the calm adventures of Huckleberry Finn. The change in the room was remarkable. Shadows which had lengthened and darkened over the bed in the corner had disappeared, or revealed themselves as dark images of familiar chairs and such. The light which dashed on the ceiling steadied and imitated rabbits rather than lions, and donkeys instead of ghouls. I laid a pallet for Mr. Taylor in Uncle Willie's room and crawled under Mama, who I knew for the first time was so good and righteous she could command the fretful spirits as Jesus had commanded the sea, peace, be still. 23. The children in Stamps trembled visibly with anticipation. Some adults were excited too, but to be certain, the whole young population had come down with graduation epidemic. Large classes were graduating from both the grammar school and the high school, even those who were years removed from their own day of glorious release were anxious to help with preparations as a kind of dry run. The junior students who were moving into the vacating classes' chairs were tradition-bound to show their talents for leadership and management. They strutted through the school and around the campus, exerting pressure on the lower grades. Their authority was so new that occasionally, if they pressed a little too hard, it had to be overlooked. After all, next term was coming, and it never hurt a sixth grader to have a play sister in the eighth grade, or a tenth year student to be able to call a twelfth grader Bubba. So all was endured in a spirit of shared understanding. But the graduating classes themselves were the nobility. Like travelers with exotic destinations on their minds, the graduates were remarkably forgetful. They came to school without their books, or tablets, or even pencils.
volunteers fell over themselves to secure replacements for the missing equipment. When accepted, the willing workers might or might not be thanked, and it was of no importance to the pre-graduation rites. Even teachers were respectful of the now quiet and aging seniors, and tended to speak to them, if not as equals, as beings only slightly lower than themselves. After tests were returned and grades given, the student body, which acted like an extended family, knew who did well, who excelled, and what piteous ones had failed. Unlike the white high school, Lafayette County Training School distinguished itself by having neither lawn, nor hedges, nor tennis court, nor climbing ivy. Its two buildings, main classrooms, the grade school, and home economics, were set on a dirt hill with no fence to limit either its boundaries or those of bordering farms. There was a large expanse to the left of the school, which was used alternately as a baseball diamond or basketball court. Rusty hoops on the swaying poles represented the permanent recreational equipment. Although bats and balls could be borrowed from the PE teacher, if the borrower was qualified and if the diamond wasn't occupied. Over this rocky area, relieved by a few shady tall persimmon trees, the graduating class walked. The girls often held hands and no longer bothered to speak to the lower students. There was a sadness about them, as if this old world was not their home, and they were bound for higher ground. The boys, on the other hand, had become more friendly, more outgoing, a decided change from the closed attitude they projected while studying for finals. Now they seemed not ready to give up the old school, the familiar paths, and classrooms. Only a small percentage would be continuing on to college, one of the South's A&M agricultural and mechanical schools, which trained Negro youths to be carpenters, farmers, handymen, masons, maids, cooks, and baby nurses. Their future rode heavily on their shoulders and blinded them to the collective joy that had pervaded the lives of the boys and girls in the grammar school graduating class. Parents who could afford it had ordered new shoes and ready-made clothes for themselves from Sears and Roebuck or Montgomery Ward. They also engaged the best seamstresses to make the floating graduating dresses and to cut down secondhand pants, which would be pressed to a military slickness for the important event. Oh, it was important, all right. White folks would attend the ceremony, and two or three of them would speak of God and home and the Southern way of life. And Mrs. Parsons, the principal's wife, would play the graduation march, while the lower grade graduates paraded down the aisles and took their seats below the platform. The high school seniors would wait in empty classrooms to make their dramatic entrance. In the store, I was the person of the moment, the birthday girl, the center. Bailey had graduated the year before, although to do so he had had to forfeit all pleasures to make up for his time lost in Baton Rouge. My class was wearing butter yellow pique dresses, and Mama launched out on mine. She smocked the yoke into tiny crisscrossing puckers, then shirred the rest of the bodice. Her dark fingers ducked in and out of the lemony cloth as she embroidered raised daisies around the hem. Before she considered herself finished, she had added a crocheted cuff on the puff sleeves and a pointy crocheted collar. I was going to be lovely, a walking model of all the various styles of fine hand sewing. And it didn't worry me that I was only 12 years old
and merely graduating from the eighth grade. Besides, many teachers in Arkansas Negro schools had only that diploma and were licensed to impart wisdom. The days had become longer and more noticeable. The faded beige of former times had been replaced with strong and sure colors. I began to see my classmates' clothes, their skin tones, and the dust that waved off pussy willows. Clouds that lazed across the sky were objects of great concern to me. Their shiftier shapes might have held a message that in my new happiness, and with a little bit of time, I'd soon decipher. During that period, I looked at the arch of heaven so religiously, my neck kept a steady ache. I had taken to smiling more often, and my jaws hurt from the unaccustomed activity. Between the two physical sore spots, I suppose I could have been uncomfortable, but that was not the case. As a member of the winning team, the graduating class of 1940, I had outdistanced unpleasant sensations by miles. I was headed for the freedom of open fields. Youth and social approval allied themselves with me, and we trammeled memories of slights and insults. The wind of our swift passage remodeled my features. Lost tears were pounded to mud and then to dust. Years of withdrawal were brushed aside and left behind as hanging ropes of parasitic moss. My work alone had awarded me a top place, and I was going to be one of the first called in the graduating ceremonies. On the classroom blackboard, as well as on the bulletin board in the auditorium, there were blue stars and white stars and red stars. No absences, no tardinesses, and my academic work was among the best of the year. I could say the preamble to the Constitution even faster than Bailey. We timed ourselves often. We, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union. I had memorized the presidents of the United States, from Washington to Roosevelt, in chronological as well as alphabetical order. My hair pleased me, too. Gradually, the black mass had lengthened and thickened so that it kept at least to its braided pattern, and I didn't have to yank my scalp off when I tried to comb it. Louise and I had rehearsed the exercises until we tired ourselves out. Henry Reed was class valedictorian. He was a small, very black boy with hooded eyes, a long, broad nose, and an oddly shaped head. I had admired him for years because each term he and I vied for the best grades in our class. Most often he bested me, but instead of being disappointed, I was pleased that we shared top places between us. Like many Southern black children, he lived with his grandmother, who was as strict as Mama and as kind as she knew how to be. He was courteous, respectful, and soft-spoken to elders, but on the playground, he chose to play the roughest games. I admired him. Anyone, I reckon, sufficiently afraid or sufficiently dull could be polite, but to be able to operate at a top level with both adults and children was admirable. His valedictory speech was entitled, To Be or Not to Be. The rigid 10th grade teacher had helped him write it. He'd been working on the dramatic stresses for months. The weeks until graduation were filled with heady activities. A group of small children were to be presented in a play about buttercups and daisies and bunny rabbits. They could be heard throughout the building practicing their hops and their little songs that sounded like silver bells. The older girls, non-graduates of course, were assigned the task of making refreshments for the night's festivities. A tangy scent of ginger, cinnamon, nutmeg, and chocolate wafted around the home economics building as the budding cooks
made samples for themselves and their teachers. In every corner of the workshop, axes and saws.